Episode 81, The Oregon Trail, The Mormons, and the California Gold Rush. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. This past February, the San Francisco 49ers lost the Super Bowl to the Kansas City Chiefs, and that brings up the inevitable question, what the heck is a 49er? Why are they named that? I will explain shortly. Also, you may have wondered, why the heck do so many Mormons live in Salt Lake City, Utah? I'll explain that shortly, too. Before we get to San Francisco and Utah, we sort of have to go to Oregon because, well, it's just a lot easier to get to than California, especially if you're in Missouri and planning on going there by foot. Honestly, I can't imagine being in Missouri and thinking that I was about to embark on a walk of 2,000 miles to Oregon. I mean, that's farther than Frodo and Sam walked when they went from the Shire to Mordor. But that's what people did, and a lot of people did, back in the 1840s and the 1850s. And actually, now that I think about it, it does sound kind of fun. So why even have an episode about the Oregon Trail? I mean, there's a trail out behind my house that I walk on sometimes, but it doesn't deserve a whole podcast episode. Well, the Oregon Trail is noteworthy and episode-worthy because of just how many people used it. Between 1836 and 1870, more than 500,000 people used the trail to travel from Missouri to the West Coast. 500,000, that's a pretty substantial migration, and it was one of the things that embedded the idea of the Wild West into the American consciousness. The Oregon Trail started in Independence, Missouri. It followed a path westward through Kansas, and then north a bit into Nebraska, then across almost all of Nebraska, then across all of Wyoming, Idaho, and nearly all of Oregon. It was, as I said, over 2,000 miles long. The path it followed was basically the path of least resistance. It went to the north of Colorado because there was a much easier pass through the Rocky Mountains there in Wyoming. There were some very hard bits still, and the route had to be started in April or May to ensure that all the mountains could be crossed in the summer months. There were also branches of the trail that ended up in Northern California and a branch that ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah. That was the part that was followed by a whole lot of Mormons. One of the more interesting features of the trail is a rock in western Wyoming known as Independence Rock. It's approximately the halfway point of the trail, and travelers were supposed to get to the rock by July 4th. That meant that they were on schedule. Thousands of travelers carved their names or messages to other travelers on the rock. It's still there in western Wyoming. Once you got past the rock, you climbed through a pass in the Rockies known as the South Pass, even though it's north of most of the Rockies. Then you followed the Snake River Valley through parts of Idaho and eventually followed the Columbia River through Oregon. Now, this trail was first used by Indians and fur trappers and explorers prior to it becoming a migration pathway. The first people to use the trail for migration were a missionary and his wife named Marcus and Narcissa Whitman. No relation to the Malfoys, as far as I can tell. Anyway, Marcus and his wife traveled across the trail to set up a mission station with the Cayuse Indians in Oregon in 1836. A few years later, Marcus returned back to the east, and then he got more people and he led a group of about 30 families west across the same trail, all going there to be missionaries. But news of their successful journey was published back east, and this was the first time that women had really gone across this trail, and they did it successfully. So interest was raised in migrating this way. So then, in 1842, Marcus again led a group of about 1,000 people, and this time in 120 wagons, successfully across the trail, and this was essentially the beginnings of mass immigration along the trail. The six-month-long trek was not easy. Most pioneers traveled in wagon trains for protection. An Oregon Trail wagon was about 4 feet wide by about 10 or 12 feet long. It was pulled by horses or oxen. They could cover about 15 to 20 miles in a day. Most people just walked alongside the wagons because they were very bumpy, or they rode a horse if they had it. During the day, the men would fan out from the wagon train and try to hunt things. In a few places in Wyoming, there were buffalo herds, which made for good hunting. But once they got past Independence Rock in the far west of Wyoming, they had to cross a dry desert plateau where food and water were scarce. Now, there was a trading post in western Wyoming and then another one once they got to the edge of Washington State, but there's a lot of empty land in between. Anyway, it was a hard journey, but like I said, over 500,000 people took the trip. The number of travelers jumped up a bit in 1848 when gold was discovered in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Northern California. There was also a surge of migration from 1847 to 1852 when the Mormons were forced to move out of Illinois. So now we need to leave our main trail of thought and veer off onto a side trail and talk about the Mormons. Wait just a second, though, because I have to go answer my front door. Someone is knocking. Okay, I'm back. Not to worry. It was just the Jehovah's Witnesses. So the Mormons do not actually call themselves the Mormons. They call themselves the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Latter-day Saints, or LDS, if you want to get really concise. The reason they are called Mormons by other people is that they believe in the Book of Mormon, which was written by a prophet named Mormon. Well, technically, the Mormons say that Mormon himself just collected the writings of earlier prophets and wrote them down on plates of gilded metal. And just before he died, Mormon passed these sheets off to his son Moroni. Moroni then buried the plates somewhere in upstate New York. And these were later found, thousands of years later, by Joseph Smith, who I will come back to in a second. The Book of Mormon tells the story of the descendants of Nephi, who supposedly was part of the lost tribes of Israel. Back in about 700 BC, the north part of the nation of Israel was captured by the Assyrians, and they were taken back to Assyria, and those 10 tribes of the north basically disappeared, leaving only the tribes of Judah and Benjamin in the Promised Land. This is talked about in the Bible in the second book of Kings, and we mentioned it in the podcast back in episode 7. Oh my God, that's so long ago. The Book of Mormon says that some of the people from Israel sailed to the Americas and established a civilization in the northeast of America. The Book of Mormon has a lot of detail about the lives and civilizations of these descendants. But there has never been any other corroborating archaeological support for the existence of this civilization, other than the golden plates that were discovered by Joseph Smith, but which mysteriously vanished, and no one other than Smith ever saw them. Smith was supposedly guided to the stones by Moroni himself, who appeared to Smith as an angel. Also, the golden plates were written in an ancient language, which Smith called Reformed Egyptian, in which Smith himself obviously couldn't read, so Moroni also gave him two stones called the Urim and the Thummim, which when he looked through them, let him see the words in English. So using this process, he translated the gold plates into the English of the Book of Mormon. Now Smith himself was born in 1805 in Carthage, Vermont, and when he was about 11, his family had moved to Palmyra, New York. The family, including Joseph, reportedly were involved in treasure hunting. When Joseph was 21, he supposedly had his first revelation from Moroni. Depending on whose report you listen to, Smith was either a treasure-seeking charlatan, or if you listen to the Mormon story, he was a sincere seeker after God who found a completely new revelation of God, Jesus, and history. Basically, it depends on whether you're looking at a Mormon source or a non-Mormon source. Either way, he got to work translating, or inventing, the writing that was on the gold tablets, and once he was done, he got them published. Now, as part of the environment of the time, America was in the middle of the Second Great Awakening, and religious interest and religious feeling were high. We talked about the First Great Awakening, which happened not too long before the Revolutionary War, back in episode 57. It's called the Great Awakening and the American Enlightenment. The Second Great Awakening happened from the early 1800s until about 1835, and it affected millions of people across the eastern seaboard of the United States. Well, in the middle of that, Smith began preaching and sharing what he had discovered, the English version of it anyway, and soon he had a few hundred followers. Part of the unique appeal of this new group, the Mormons, was that they took church life very seriously, and people were quickly put into positions of responsibility, and men were sent out to other towns and villages to make more converts. So the group grew rapidly, but very quickly they also faced opposition, and they were soon driven out of New York. And this began a cycle that repeated itself several times until they eventually moved to Salt Lake City. Basically, the Mormons would become so numerous in an area that the other residents of that area would drive them out, and then the Mormons would move west. This happened from New York to Ohio, then from Ohio to Missouri, and then from Missouri to Illinois, and then eventually all the way to Salt Lake City. In 1838, the people of Independence, Missouri, got together to drive out the Mormons who had gathered there, who this time had tried to arm themselves to be able to defend themselves. But then they were threatened by a local militia that had been raised by the non-Mormon population. And so the Mormons left again, and they moved into a sort of uninhabited part of southern Illinois, and they founded the town of Nauvoo, Illinois. The Mormons grew rapidly in Nauvoo, partly because they were encouraged to have large families, and also due to a lot of converts who came from other places and were attracted by the seriousness and the religious rituals that they follow, as well as some of Smith's doctrines, which I'll get to in a minute. Smith, for his part, received further revelations from Moroni while he was in Nauvoo, including a revelation that it was okay for him to have multiple wives, and he eventually had about 30. And this became standard Mormon doctrine for quite a while. This also may have been what attracted some of his followers, I suspect. In 1844, Smith had become so popular in southern Illinois that he was asked to run for president of the United States, and he did. But at the same time, trouble was brewing with the other settlers in other parts of Illinois near Nauvoo. Smith and his brother were arrested, and while they were in the county jail, the jail was attacked by a mob, and Smith and his brother were killed. Now, this, of course, made Smith and his brother martyrs within the Mormon Church, and that only increased their popularity within the church. So leadership of the Mormons fell to Smith's second-in-command, Brigham Young. It was Brigham Young who led the Mormons to Salt Lake City, and when they got there, they basically ran the whole territory. Eventually, almost 100,000 Mormons migrated across the Oregon Trail, but they didn't go to Oregon on the Oregon Trail. In southwest Wyoming, they turned southwest instead of northwest, and then so they went to Salt Lake City in Utah. Now, I mentioned the Mormon practice of polygamy, being able to have multiple wives. In addition to this, Smith established some very nice temples and had services modeled after some of the temple services in the Old Testament. And this also attracted some followers because it was very grandiose. The Mormons also believe that the Book of Mormon, plus their two other books, the Pearl of Great Price and the Doctrine and Covenants, are of equal value and spiritual authority to the Bible. Mormons also have a different view of the spiritual origin of man than does traditional Christianity. Mormons believe, it's a core belief of Mormonism, that God himself was once a man on another planet, and that he lived a righteous life on that planet, and thus he was given the right to be the God of this planet. Righteous men, that is, Mormons, on this planet will later, once they die, also be given the right to be gods over other planets, that is, as long as they live a righteous life according to the Mormon standards. Now, women, on the other hand, only get this privilege of being a god, goddess, I guess, over another planet if they are called into heaven by their husbands. And there in heaven, the husband and his wife, or wives, create spiritual babies, and those babies, those souls in heaven, become the occupants of the planet that the God and goddess have been given. Now, needless to say, this goes really strongly against the traditional teachings of the rest of the church, and this is part of the reason that the Mormons kept being driven out of places until they got to Utah, where there was no one who would be able to drive them out. Now, if this was a podcast on theology rather than history, I would spend more time on this, but I'll just say here that there isn't a single branch of traditional Christianity that agrees with the Mormon claim that they are also Christians. While Mormonism today has a public image of being a kind of white bread, family-centered, wholesome version of Christianity, It wasn't always viewed that way by the other Christian denominations that it encountered, and that, as I said, is one of the reasons people kept driving them out. But this brings up one of the fundamental questions of religious freedom that has been part of the identity of the United States from the beginning. How, as a society that values freedom of religion, do you keep people from just making religious stuff up and then deceiving a whole bunch of people? Like Scientology, for example, or other random religious cults? Or what do you do about people who actively follow Satanism? Most rational people would agree that openly following Satan is a terrible idea. And it's not something that should be protected by law, not a freedom that you should protect. But how do you decide that if your society is founded on some kind of idea of religious freedom? How do you sit in judgment of what someone believes? If I want to start a cult that says I'm the new Messiah and all of my followers should follow me and, by the way, give all their money to me, I am legally free to do so, even if I know that I'm just making it up. And we've seen again and again that people will follow these kind of charismatic podcast makers. I mean, charismatic religious leaders. Jim Jones, David Koresh, CNN. People are easily deceived and they're led astray. But how do you protect people from these kind of charlatans while still protecting people's rights to choose their own religious beliefs? You can't have the government deciding who's a Christian and who isn't. I mean, the government's all Satanists anyway nowadays, so I don't want them making that decision. Here's another weird side effect of democracy. In Utah, for a long time, Mormonism was the only allowed religion. The city of Salt Lake and the first government of the territory were completely controlled by the Mormons. They didn't let other people establish churches there within Salt Lake City for quite a while. Now, when Utah wanted to become a state, it was completely controlled by Mormons, the territory was. So the U.S. decided to let Utah in, provided that they made polygamy illegal and at least protected some religious freedoms for other religious groups. And Utah did that, even though the practice of polygamy continued for quite a while, especially in little corners of Utah. But Utah came into the Union as a state where other religions were on the books legal, but they weren't tolerated. Does religious freedom at the federal level mean that at the local level, a religious institution can take control of its local legislature and say, for example, that Christianity is illegal? What about the strongly Muslim communities today in parts of Michigan? Are those communities free to impose Sharia law on the town or city in which they control the local government? Freedom of religion creates a bunch of problems, especially if a strong majority group takes power in a town or a state and begins to persecute a minority religion. Should there be some kind of federal protection for the oppressed minority? Maybe. But that creates the problem of what to do if the oppressed minority is a wacky cult. And also, it also creates the problem of having the federal government involved in this at all. I don't want the federal government deciding what I can or can't believe. Should the wacky cult be protected? Should I be protected? I don't know. I don't see an easy answer to this. There's no real clear answer to getting the federal government involved in what people believe. But the side effect of this is that people can create all sorts of weird, crazy ideas and get people to follow them, even though that's really dangerous. Anyway, the Mormons moved to Salt Lake using the Oregon Trail to escape this kind of persecution, and they set up a successful colony there. Other settlers moved to Oregon using the Oregon Trail, but some moved to California, following a southern branch of the trail. And this California part of the trail exploded in terms of numbers in 1848 and 1849. Why? Because in 1848, gold was discovered in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California near Sacramento. This is going to become one of the biggest gold finds in all of human history. On January 24th of 1848, a carpenter was trying to build a water-powered sawmill in the hills. He was going to build this small waterfall to power his saw, a technique that had been used back in the East for some time. In building his waterfall, though, he found flakes in the water of what he thought were gold. He had them tested, and sure enough, they were indeed gold. Now, despite the fact that he was trying to keep this secret, News of the discovery spread quickly, and people began to rush to California from all over. Now, California at this point was really hard to get to, including coming from South America, China, and the eastern United States. The earliest prospectors were able to find, in some places, about $1,000 worth of gold in a day. And that was back when $1,000 really meant something. That's like finding $40,000 in a day today. And a few people found huge chunks of gold, so the news of these discoveries kept spreading. The real peak of people coming to California was in 1849, as almost 100,000 people flooded into California. The existing locals, who were deeply frustrated by the endless stream of know-nothing newcomers, derisively called these new people 49ers, implying they had just gotten here and they didn't know anything. However, after some time had passed, the name 49er came to symbolize the eager, adventurous people who had taken big risks trying to strike gold. Eventually, the term became a positive one, and the idea of striking it rich became another part of the American dream. And eventually, the name 49er was applied to an NFL football team. Now, there are a couple of other NFL teams with similar historical names, including the New England Patriots, the Dallas Cowboys, the Green Bay Packers, who are named after the meatpacking industry of Green Bay, and the Houston Oilers, who no longer exist, but at one point were named after the oil field workers from the oil industry near Houston. You could maybe make a case for the name Washington Commanders, which is a stupid name, but it does seem to fit, since there have actually been a few Commanders from the Washington, D.C. area. It's kind of ironic that they used to be called the Washington Redskins, after how badly the U.S. federal government historically treated the Indians. A better name for that team would have been the Washington Grifters, or maybe now the Washington Tyrants, or the Washington Swamp. That fits in a couple ways. Anyway, a lot of people came across the Oregon Trail for a wide variety of reasons. Some died of dysentery, but some survived and populated the west coast of America. California became so populated that it became a state in 1850, and it came in as a free state, which led to an imbalance of power in the U.S. Senate that's not going to go well. But before we get to that, we actually have to look at something back east that was happening in 1848. Way back east, in fact, back over in Europe, as basically the entire continent of Europe decides, hey, it's time to have a revolution. Join us next episode as we look at the revolutions of 1848.